Welcome to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Thanks for being with us this Friday. Well, the state of Florida will spend about $24 billion on education, and that isn't for colleges and universities. No, a new investigation by the Orlando Sentinel found that $1 billion in state-funded scholarships is actually going to private schools.
Melissa, sometimes these scholarships are called school vouchers. More than 100,000 students will use the money to attend private schools throughout the state. Now, these private schools don't necessarily have to follow the same academic standards or even the same recess requirements that traditional public schools and even charter schools have to here in Florida. Now, the Orlando Sentinel's investigation found private schools receiving state scholarship money, this state voucher money, even though they falsified safety records and some aren't even required to have certified teachers.
That's right, Tom. So here are some questions as we kick off the roundup this Friday. Does your child attend a private school on a state scholarship? Do you work at a private school? What do you think about the news that nearly $1 billion in Florida tax money is going toward private schools with lax oversight? Give us a call from anywhere in the state. Let us know what you think. The number to join the roundup, 305-995-1800, as we discuss this investigation into Florida state scholarships. This series is called Schools Without Rules and How the Vouchers Are Spent, as we welcome Annie Martin, staff writer at the Orlando Sentinel, and Jessica Bateman. She's education reporter with WLRN. Annie, let's start with you. What a deep dive the Sentinel took into this. Let's begin by asking, what are the requirements for a student in Florida to be able to use a voucher to attend a private school?
Well, there's three different programs. One of them is for students from low-income families, so they have to meet an income requirement. It's about $50,000 a year for a family of four. And the other two programs are specifically for students with disabilities. For one of the programs, they have to have like a 504 plan or an IEP, you know, similar to what they would have in a public school. Or there's a second program that's for students with very specific disabilities.
Right. And so the investigation was fascinating in the sense that you looked at a number of schools, kids coming in with different backgrounds, but what you seemed to find quite often was lax oversight. That was some really eye-popping examples of that. What were some of the examples that stood out to you and your colleagues the most?
Well, we have reviewed dozens of complaints that parents had made to the DOE about private schools that participate in these scholarship programs. And the complaints ranged from, I don't think my child is getting a good education, I don't think their teacher is qualified to be in the classroom, to complaints about the facilities, you know, having facilities that were dilapidated or books that were out of date. So the complaints really ranged. Now, the DOE can't take action except for on very specific things. They can revoke a private school from the program if they are operating in a facility that has not been approved or hasn't had a fire inspection, or if they've hired people that have criminal backgrounds that should exclude them from working in the school. But other than that, the DOE really can't take any action in cases where a parent calls or writes in and says, you know, there's really no learning going on here. I don't think my child is getting a good education here. So that was really eye-opening for us.
Jessica Bakeman, let me ask you, lack of state oversight here, but isn't this state money?
So for the tax credit scholarships, they are actually money that the state is forfeiting that it otherwise would collect in tax revenue. Mm-hmm. So if you're a corporation and you owe $10,000 in taxes, you can instead donate $10,000 to a nonprofit organization that gives out these scholarships, and so you get that credit. So in the case of the tax credit scholarship, it's sort of a nuanced answer as to whether it is state money, because that money is actually never touching the treasury. It's the state saying, we're willing to forfeit this money. The other programs that Annie mentioned, the for students with disabilities, mm-hmm. those are actually tax dollars that are in the state treasury that then get allocated for those programs.
Annie, is that why there is such a lack of state oversight, that these funds don't go through the traditional funding mechanism that K through 12 dollars do?
Well, I think it's that this program has been set up so that the parents are really the accountability mechanism. The philosophy is that if the parents are unsatisfied with the school that they've chosen, they can take their child out and send their scholarship dollars to a different school. And I think the theory is that that will weed out some of the bad actors because they, you know, simply won't be able to attract families. But really, the way the laws are written, there's very little that the State Department of Education is really allowed to act on.
And if you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup as we discuss the biggest stories around the state. Right now, we're looking at schools without rules, the Orlando Sentinel's deep dive into what are called vouchers, state scholarships. An investigation found nearly $1 billion in taxpayer money is actually going to private schools around the state. But there's lax oversight, and many parents complain that their kids are not getting the education they had hoped for. And sometimes there are safety code violations, other problems. What are your thoughts? What are your questions? The number to join the show right now, 305-995-1800. We're going to begin with Eddie in Miami. Eddie, are you a teacher? Good afternoon. Thanks for calling into the roundup. Go
ahead. Hi, I'm actually a teacher for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And I have nothing against scholarships, but as long as they're being used correctly, you know, scholarships for a higher education. If a parent wants to send their child to a private school, they should pay out of pocket. As it stands, the public school system is already hurting on money. Right now, they're actually doing the negotiations for teacher salaries, and it's looking like there might not even be an increase for teacher salaries. And even some of the facilities in our schools are in really bad shape, and they need that extra money. And I know that they mentioned that this money is not coming directly from the Treasury, but to me that seems like a semantic gymnastics, really, because at the end of the day, this is $1 billion we're talking about.
Thank you.
And our schools are really hurting for it.
Thanks, Eddie. You know, yeah. Jessica, that's the knock on these types of programs, that they siphon money away from public education. Supporters say they're providing choice and competition. In the wake of this investigation, though, there have been calls for more oversight. Isn't that right?
Yes. I think there are always calls for more oversight coming from Democrats in the state legislature, coming from school board members and superintendents in a lot of cases who want to see more money going to the public school system. And like you said, see this as an effort to siphon away funding. I saw that Senator David Simmons, who's a Republican in the state legislature, has said that, you know, he thought the Orlando Sentinel's investigation was eye-opening and that it could prompt some changes. But I think the reality is the legislature is not a place where the lawmakers are just really not interested in those kind of changes, yeah. Especially in the conservative House of Representatives, which is led by Richard Corcoran, who is a huge proponent of these programs.
Right. And Annie, it's more a sense of when it comes to these private institutions, the legislature has typically been very much hands off. And the philosophy has been let market forces decide. Hasn't that been more the overriding philosophy?
It definitely has. And advocates of the school choice programs will say, you know, these are very popular with parents, and there's no shortage of parents in the state who want a scholarship for their children to attend these schools. But I also think that there's not a ton of publicly available information for parents to base their decisions on. You can't, you know, as you would for a public school, you can't go to the DOE's website and find out how students at one of these private schools fared on a standardized test, you know, last year to get a sense as to how students are performing there.
That's because they may not have to take them, right? I mean, it's the catch-22 of the private school.
That's right. The scholarship students, the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship students, do have to take a standardized test, but it doesn't have to be the Florida Standards Assessment. So it's really impossible to make an apples-to-apples comparison to, you know, how they're faring compared to their counterparts in the public schools. And there's no penalty for schools that, you know, repeatedly show that their students are not performing well on these tests. Even though students have to take the test, there's no, you know, they won't get kicked out of the program if they don't do well.
That's Annie Martin, investigative reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Jessica Bakeman covers education at WLRN Public Radio in Miami. You are listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition here. Join the conversation, 305-995-1800 statewide. That's the phone number, Melissa, 305-995-1800 in Palmetto Bay in Dade County. Chris, you are on the radio. Go ahead, Chris, your thoughts.
Hi. Well, I have to say that I feel compelled to sort of correct some of the misstatements there. I mean, the RAND study on charter schools in Florida is probably the gold standard of studies of charter schools. Found 96% of parents that went to whose children were enrolled in charter or alternative schools were exceedingly happy, which is a number that exceeds the standard in the public schools by more than 3-1. It also found, that same study found, that students in charter schools, while predominantly minorities and disadvantaged children, outperformed their counterparts in the public schools by 5-10% on all standardized measures and go to college in higher numbers than public school students. Based on this and the fact that we spend here in Dade County more than $12,700 per student, and charter schools are giving better results at 10% or more cost savings, I don't think that you are giving an objective
Chris, just to be fair, you're talking about charter schools, correct?
I'm talking about charter and alternate schools.
And what do you mean by define alternate? What is that, homeschool?
It certainly includes.
Okay.
If you look
so we can talk. I understand, but just so we can talk oranges and oranges here in Florida, you're talking about charter, homeschool, private school. But the Orlando Sentinel investigation looked at solely private schools. Is that correct, Annie?
But the RAND study.
Is that correct, Annie? Right.
Yeah,
okay.
We did not look at charter schools for this story.
Right. So
RAND,
Chris, I think to be fair and objective, Chris, I understand, but you're not, though, Chris. So,
but each category of those things is outperforming the public schools.
All right.
So, you can argue that they outperform it by different measures.
Okay.
But nonetheless, to present them, first of all, the charter schools and the other things were designed to have less oversight. Less oversight does not mean lack of oversight. It means different oversight.
Right.
But your head
so,
right.
And you know what, though? But I do think, jumping in, that while you raise an important point, Chris, this deep dive looked at funding of scholarships for vouchers to students, particularly students going. And let me jump in and ask another important question, because the majority of these kids are enrolled in religious schools. Annie Martin with the Orlando Sentinel, isn't that right? The vast majority of these students are opting out of public schools and taking vouchers because the family wants them to get a religious education. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, most of the students that use these scholarships are attending religious schools, mostly Christian schools. It was interesting, though, of the parents that we spoke with, while that may have been something that they liked about the school they had chosen for their child, it didn't really seem to be the motivating factor for them. I think the thing that we heard the most often, one of the things we heard most often, were that they either thought their students were being tested too much, or they didn't like the high-stakes nature of the testing in the public schools. And that was somewhat surprising to me. I've covered education for about 8 years, and mostly in Florida. And I guess I didn't quite realize what a powerful force that was for parents and you know, them opting for the private school route for their children.
Let me just jump in. Testing is something that, whether parents are opting out or not, parents across the board are pushing back against standardized testing in this state. Isn't that fair to say?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, there are parents who have children in public schools who've, opted out of the state test by asking their child to not participate in that, or have, petitioned the state or their local school board members on this issue. So certainly, yeah, that's a big concern for parents.
Jessica, let me have you respond to what Chris in Palmetto Bay was saying in terms of the performance of students that are not in traditional public schools. And he cited a study that looks at other alternative schools, including charter schools and private schools, and other alternative choices that parents may have for their kids and for their education. And as he points out, this study breaks apart those into the basis. What do we know about that performance in terms of the kinds of education choices that a Florida parent has and the performance of those education choices?
So, Tom, I'm not sure the study that he was specifically talking about. Of course, there have been lots of studies on this, and they've shown a variety of things in terms of, you know, trying to compare the performance. And as Annie was getting at, it's difficult to compare the performance directly because if kids are not taking the same tests or being held accountable to the same standards and the same rules, you know, it's not where you can make that direct comparison and say students in this type of school are doing so much better, you know. And obviously performance even among traditional public schools varies widely depending on a lot of factors, including funding resources.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup, our statewide show looking at the biggest headlines from the week across the Sunshine State. The number to call us up right now, 305-995-1800, as we look at the Orlando Sentinel investigation. Schools without rules, state-funded scholarships, nearly $1 billion worth of your tax dollars went to private schools. Let's go now to Katie in Jacksonville. Hi, Katie. Good afternoon to you. Go ahead.
Hi. My question mostly pertains to the McKay Scholarship, which is given to kids with various disabilities that could affect learning, one of which being speech services. In my experience and looking into schools in the Jacksonville area that take this scholarship, they're more than happy to accept the scholarship, but they're not providing the services that the kids need. So, for instance, my kids are currently in Duval County Schools. My son was receiving 5 to 10 minutes of speech instruction daily, 5 days a week. But when I had contacted different private schools about using a McKay scholarship and receiving those services there, I was kind of met with, you know, well, we have it, but it's not available in the same way it is in the public schools. So I want to know who is holding the schools that are accepting these vouchers accountable.
Gotcha, Katie. Sure. Jessica Bateman, what about that? What about that, the McKay Scholarship accountability?
So she really raises an important point, which is that when your child is in a public school and has a disability, he or she is entitled under federal law to special education services. And when you put your child in a private school, you no longer have that same protection. So you may accept a McKay or a Gardner scholarship, that's the other voucher for students with disabilities, and use it to put your child in a private school. And whether that private school is going to have those services varies completely by school, and there's really no one making sure that they are providing it.
Jessica Bakeman, covering education for WLRN Public Media in Miami. Annie Martin has joined us as well from Orlando, where she's a staff writer for the Orlando Sentinel. Annie, thanks for sharing your reporting with the state of Florida. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Still to come, how Governor Scott wants to spend more than $1.5 billion on the environment. You're listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
Well, Governor Rick Scott announced his budget proposal this week for Florida's environment. And Tom, it is to the tune of $1.7 billion. That's billion with a B.
Yeah, lots of zeros there. Scott's spending plan, Melissa, includes money for the Everglades to restore that area, also land conservation. But it does little for water quality improvements around Florida.
That's right. We're talking about it now with reporter John Davis of WGCU in Fort Myers. Also with us, WGCU Interim News Director Julie Glenn. And we want to talk to all of you out there. Give us a call with your thoughts about this here on the Roundup at 305-995-1800. What do you think of the governor's record on the environment? Could it have anything to do with his future political plans? John, let's begin with you. The governor's proposal includes money for Florida Forever. Now, that, of course, is the state's main land conservation program, and he would set aside $50 million for Florida Forever. How is Governor Scott proposing that money be used?
Well, in his remarks on Monday, he didn't identify specific projects or pieces of land, but we do understand that through the governor's proposal, this money would be funneled through the state's land acquisition list. And here's how that works. Florida Forever follows a priority list of critical natural lands, which for this year includes 120 swaths or parcels of land that are in various stages of actually being acquired by the state. But to date, Florida Forever and its predecessor Preservation 2000 have contributed to the purchase of more than 2.5 million acres of conservation areas around the state. So this is looking to add to that. But I think this is more about a funding allocation than it is about targeting specific projects, because those priority lists of critical lands already exist.
And what's the reaction from environmental groups, state agencies, and so forth about the announcement so far?
As you mentioned in the introduction, there is some concern. Environmental advocates do wish that this had included money specifically for water quality improvement projects beyond just in South Florida. Eric Draper with Audubon Florida has talked about Lake Apopka in Central Florida, saying, it's the most polluted lake in the state. Now, this proposal doesn't necessarily preclude lawmakers from funding cleanup for Lake Apopka when they convene the session in January. It's just not specifically in the governor's budget proposal.
John, it's a $1.7 billion proposal. We're talking about the $50 million thin, tiny slice there of a much larger spending pie, but I want to continue focusing on that a little bit, because it's about land purchase. $50 million is still really a fraction of what the state used to spend on land acquisition for environmental efforts, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. In pre-recession years, Florida Forever would regularly receive funding to the tune of some $300 million. In the current state fiscal year that we're in now, lawmakers actually allocated nothing for the program. And in the 3 years prior to that, funding levels dwindled down to below $20 million. It isn't something that lawmakers have necessarily made as much of a priority as voters would have liked them to. And I think we saw that in 2014. When 75% of voters in the state, voted to approve Amendment 1, and that set aside a specific dedicated source of funding for conservation land acquisition.
I can imagine, Melissa, there's a lot of folks maybe shaking their head or scratching their head saying, didn't I vote to buy land to protect it in the environment? Didn't I say, let's
Over
use some of this tax money?
75% of the voters voted in Amendment 1. It was passed. Tom, how often do amendments pass at above the 60% threshold in this state? Not often. Amendment 1 passed by above 75%. And that amendment said, overwhelmingly, the voters said, we want to preserve the state's most vulnerable and valuable natural lands. And an overwhelming mandate to do that. And still, this is still very much an open question as to whether that's going to actually happen in this state. And so, John, looking at this through a political lens, what about the governor's, possible future run for the U.S. Senate and so forth? Cynics might say he's tinkering around now with these environmental moves as he makes a move to the center. What are your thoughts about that?
If you look at the governor's record on environmental issues, going back to when his first term in office in 2011, there's a clear pattern that emerges. And what you see is a governor who tends to side with deregulation. I don't know how much time we have, but I can go list lots and lots of examples here. But then whenever he's up for re-election, as we saw in 2014, his tune changes quite a bit. And that's when we start start to see a lot more talk about the environment. And of course, this was the governor's last, this is going to be his last year. He's term limited out, but he's widely speculated to run for U.S. Senate. So if 2014, if what we've been seeing over the past 7 years is any indication, this could be part of that pattern to, sort of create the appearance of a strong environmental record.
One could say, though, couldn't one, John, that 2014, the Florida economy had recovered considerably from when the governor originally took office in 2010. So the budget cuts that he instituted, including taking money away from the conservation efforts, those needs had been reduced because the economy had rebounded, and much the same for this case. I imagine that would be an argument the governor and his supporters would make in terms of his environmental record.
Well, but it's not just about spending allocations, Tom. I mean, if you look at what he did in his first term, we also saw water management districts, their boards. He was putting on, land use attorneys and people who previous governor's administrations would not have considered qualified to be in those positions. And other actions like that, we saw, budget decreases being asked for the DEP again, just about every year except for 2014.
All right, and our number to join the Florida Roundup is 305-995-1800. What do you think of the governor's record on Florida's environment? Here's what he wants, his eighth and final budget proposal. He is term limited. This is what Rick Scott wants: $355 million for Everglades restoration, $55 million for freshwater springs, $100 million to restore the state's beaches in the wake of Hurricane Irma. And Tom, he wants $40 million increase in spending for the state's parks. But John, what about the fact that Hurricane Irma was so incredibly expensive for the entire state that a lot of this, really, the state's chief economist is saying any budget surplus for the Florida Forever program, the land conservation program, that's already been wiped out. So are these numbers just pie in the sky when we look at what the state went through with Hurricane Irma and everything that is costing us?
Monday after I covered the governor's announcement and I had gone home, and long after I should have been in bed, I was on the phone with my environmental advocacy sources just trying to make sense of this, because I didn't understand why we have the state's chief economist, Amy Baker, telling us that we should be expecting budget shortfalls, and the governor's telling us that, I can quote him here too. He's talking about saying that we're walking into surpluses. And whenever I asked him directly about that, and it was the only question I was actually able to ask at the event, he said, we have dramatically increased our revenues in the state. We're walking into budget surpluses. We already have record funding for K-12 education, state colleges and universities. See, so he says, we have the money if you look at the budget.
And that was the
answer to the question.
So
what I'm waiting for really is just to see a more complete budget proposal. What we saw announced Monday was just this piecemeal announcement about this one aspect of the budget. So I'm really looking forward to, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, going through the full budget proposal line by line and seeing if there's some magic.
And let me ask you guys, too, very quickly. Just yesterday, President Trump says he wants to fix the Hoover Dyke along Lake Okeechobee. Is that a way for the president to also bolster Governor Scott's future political aspirations in this state? Is that something else that's going on that we can look at as we have an environmental discussion that also has some political undercurrents?
Well, I think it's no secret that Governor Scott and President Trump are allies, and they both have similar backgrounds in terms of being from the business world and being, quote unquote, political outsiders who are, Governor Scott ran for governor, and that was the first time he'd held public office. President Trump, his first public office being the presidency. There's a lot of similarities in their stories there. But Trump had previously pledged to fast-track upgrades to the dike around Lake Okeechobee, right, earlier, saying that he wanted to get that work done by 2022. to. And of course, for the folks who are living around the lake, I think with water levels approaching or surpassing 17 feet, that's a concern. I mean, the Herbert Hoover Dyke, if it were a person, it would be an octogenarian. It's old. It needs repair. Well,
it dates back to the administration for which it is named.
Hoover.
No doubt about it. And I would argue that the Hoover Dyke restoration and fixes are really more of a public safety issue as opposed to an environmental issue necessarily. But John, I want to ask you just a quick question.
Sure.
And follow the money here. Where is the governor finding these dollars? Is it from the Amendment 1, the approved environmental spending ballot measure that's in the Florida Constitution now?
That's correct, Tom. That is one thing we do know about the budget proposal is that he does want to see the Florida Forever spending money sort of be siphoned through that one-third of documentary stamp tax collections that Amendment 1 specifically set up to be set aside for conservation land buying.
All right. Let's bring in Julie Glenn, also of WGCU. As we talk about Florida and its environment and its water, a story that caught our eye in Politico magazine the other day, Cape Coral, the boomtown that shouldn't exist, just a fascinating story looking at Cape Coral as sort of a microcosm of Florida. Development run amok. For people that have ever been to Cape Coral, they know what we're talking about. This is a city that has 400 miles of canals, the most of any city in the world. But of course, Julie, in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, those canals and their seawalls have been incredibly damaged. What happened to the seawalls there, and how are the residents of Cape Coral dealing with the aftermath of the storm?
Well, the seawalls that were put in Cape Coral were put in when Cape Coral came to exist, and that was 50 to 60 years ago. And the problem with them is that usually those seawalls have a 30-year lifespan, and many of them are still original. So what happened was a couple weeks before the hurricane came through, we had some record-breaking rainfall. And that put a lot of rain on the land side of those seawalls. And then when the hurricane came through, it did what hurricanes do and sucked all the water out into the Gulf. There were people that were able to kind of see the bottom of their canals in some places for a little while. And without that water pressing up against the water side of the seawall, a lot of them kind of crumbled. So now we have people going out in their backyard and they're looking at their land crumbling and kind of sliding into the Gulf waters that make up their canals.
Wow.
So they're saying, at the city saying, they don't have official numbers yet, but they're kind of guesstimating that 100 to 1,000 properties have seawalls that were damaged by this storm. But the issue for the people in Cape Coral is that that is theirs. They own that seawall. So they are responsible now for repairing that seawall.
Wow. So let the buyer beware, I suppose. And it's a community really unlike almost any other since of the way it was constructed. Is the city doing anything to help these homeowners repair, or are folks there in Cape Coral basically on their own?
Well, you would think they're completely on their own. It's interesting because some towns have just up the way in Punta Gorda, they have a lot of canals there. But there, those seawalls are the property of the city. That city charges an assessment. And because of that, the city was able to apply for FEMA assistance, public assistance, which is for infrastructure. So FEMA is able to help them. But the people that have homes in Cape Coral, when they apply for FEMA assistance, it's an individual grant. So that is only to bring their house up to a livable condition. That does not include that seawall. So even FEMA is not going to come through in many of these cases. And I know that Senator Bill Nelson is looking into that. He mentioned that when he was coming through town about a week ago. But the situation in Cape Coral, what they've done now is they have decided to establish a PACE program in the city. And PACE stands for Property Assessed Clean Energy. And it's a program that the state has that cities kind of have to sign up for, communities have to sign up for, well, municipalities, I suppose. And this is a way in which people can apply for a loan to have repairs done to their house or upgrades done to their house, and sometimes seawalls replaced. And then that loan is paid back through a property tax assessment over the course of 20 years. So it's a 5.99% interest rate on that loan. Mm. But what people are looking at, though, is if you have maybe a $25,000 project on your hands, it's going to add about $2,600 to your annual tax bill. And in many cases, that's more than doubling
it. Yeah. And the 6% loan rate is not exactly very market friendly in this low rate environment. Let me remind folks here, Julie, that you are listening to Florida Public Radio, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
The good part for the homeowner, the thing that one homeowner might consider to be a silver lining on this is that because it's part of your tax assessment, if you sell your house in 2 to 5 years, it may make it a tougher selling point, yeah. But at least you're walking away from that continued loan payment.
Yeah, assuming you can get rid of that. Let's go to the calls here. Statewide, 305-995-1800 here on the Florida Roundup throughout the state of Florida, talking about the environmental record and new spending that the governor wants to do, as well as protecting property throughout the state. Let's go to Palm Beach County. Tom, thanks for holding on. You're on the radio. Go ahead. Tom,
Hello,
you still with
Tom?
Us?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Now I've got you good. We voted and passed Amendment 1 so that the documentary stamp fund, some of them, would be dedicated for land purchase as conservation lands. And in 2014, when we voted in favor of that, the dollar amount was estimated to be $700 million per year. And I'm sure that dollar amount has increased since the economy has increased. And I know that may be in court right now because the legislature, and now again Governor Scott, decided, well, we'll give $50 million, but $700 million was dedicated annually at least. And so that should be a court case that should be winnable. And I wonder what the status of the legal challenge is.
John, I'll have you pipe in on that if you happen to know. But Tom, let me clarify a little bit. It wasn't a dollar figure amount that voters approved. It was a percent of documentary real estate tax collection. So as the real estate market moves up and down in Florida, that number annually, right, John, that goes into this pot of money would move up and down as well.
Correct. And they did have projections going out 20 years, how much they anticipated it would bring in. And I apologize, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I don't think it was quite that high. But the caller is correct. There was a lawsuit instituted in 2015 because even though the legislature was constitutionally mandated because of Amendment 1 to set that money aside for conservation land buying, they were using it for administrative costs.
And by the way, the bench trial is going forward next summer, guys, next summer. That is going forward.
All right.
And as I pointed out, how many amendments pass with 75% of the vote? Not many.
It was significant, and the money was significant as well. We'll have to leave it there. Folks, talking about the environment, it certainly is a topic we'll talk more about here on the Florida Roundup. John Davis with WGCU. John, great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for your time and sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
Julie Glenn is the interim news director at WGCU, sharing her reporting in and around Cape Coral. Julie, great to have you on the program as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, a new movie telling the story of a 6-year-old living on the economic edge in Florida. You are listening to Florida, the Florida Roundup, statewide edition on Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
Well, Tom, it's the breakout new independent film from writer and director Sean Baker. It's already generating major buzz ahead of awards season.
It's called The Florida Project. It is set on a stretch of highway just outside Disney World in Orlando, and it follows a 6-year-old named Mooney and her rebellious mother, Haley, over the course of really a few weeks over a single summer, Melissa.
The film stars Willem Dafoe as a budget motel manager named Bob. Mooney and her mom live week to week at Bob's place, the Magic Castle. And like a lot of kids at this hardscrabble motel, Mooney isn't always properly supervised.
It's only second week of the summer and there's already been a dead fish in the pool.
We were doing an experiment. We were trying to get it back alive. That wasn't my idea.
And water balloons thrown at tourists? You can't f*** with tourists.
They didn't tip us.
Are you serious?
No.
Oh my God, this is unacceptable. I failed as a mother, Mooney. You've disgraced me.
Harley.
Yeah, Mom, you're disgraced.
And I'm going to talk to Ashley, by the way. When your friend puts you in charge of her kid, that kid becomes your responsibility. You ain't taking responsibility.
Kevin Shenoy is a producer of The Florida Project and joins us now. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The title of this film intrigued me, and as you told me, this is a reference to the secret name Walt Disney gave his project in Central Florida decades ago when he was first planning Disney World. Fascinating. How did Sean Baker come up with this story about people scraping by on the fringes of Disney? Because it's about really the sort of the underside of the magic of Disney and the tourism economy and the people that support it, in a sense.
Sure. Sean's movies, this is actually his sixth film, and his movies are always about a place and the people that live in that place, and usually something about the economic circumstances of those people. And after we finished his previous film, Tangerine, his co-writer on that movie and on this one, Chris Burgash, his mother lived in the area, and he'd seen a news piece about the problem of the hidden homeless and these families living in these motels, and brought this situation up to Sean, and we started doing the research, probably spent a significant amount of time over about a year and a half visiting the area, talking to real-life managers like Willem plays in the movie, and, develop the story.
Now, you used non-actors alongside real actors. We heard you even went into a Walmart and just recruited real people to act in the film. Is that true?
It is true. Authenticity is so important to Sean, and spending time in these places, talking to people that were living in the motels and getting their stories. Inevitably, we met a lot of characters that we ended up putting in certain, sometimes smaller parts. But then for the children, we actually held auditions. And the little boy who plays Scooty in the movie came from one of the area motels. We brought him in for the audition, and just a very charismatic young man. And then, in fact, the girl that plays Jancy, the Mooney's best friend, was discovered in a Target.
So crazy.
Yep.
I love backstories when I talk to Hollywood film producers, don't you, Tom? Always interesting.
Nice. I'm curious, Kevin, what you as a producer and the director you worked with on this, Sean Baker, what do you want your audience to go away with? This is an audience you'll be speaking to that can afford $12 or $14 for a movie ticket. It's not the folks who are depicted in the film itself.
I mean, I tell Sean he really is as much a sociologist as he is a filmmaker. He really tends to focus on, interesting groups of people and interesting places. And, in this case, it also deals with a topic that is not just a problem in Orlando. It's a nationwide issue. And in fact, some of the research we did in other cities, San Bernardino, and, this concept of families not being able to afford, they can't get a down payment on a place, or they can't sign a lease. And so they're forced to live in these motels and actually pay more than they might otherwise, paying over $1,000 a month. But affordable housing is a nationwide problem, and we're actually, Hope 192 is a local community service organization that we spend a lot of time with, and we're actually working with them. They have a piece of land on developing some affordable housing there.
Wow. So this movie is actually involved in what you're hopeful might even drive some policy change around this issue.
Well, you can't, I wouldn't say it was an intent as we got into it, but you can't go into this and not be affected by it. I mean, we worked with families of five, a family of seven, living in a motel room like this, and you get to know and love those families, and you can't help but be impacted by it. And so we've done, since Sean has traveled to Seattle and did a screening for the Gates Foundation, he did a screening for the United Nations. And there's a lot of interest in it from that perspective, too. So I think the movie can be a lot of fun. I mean, Sean was also influenced by The Little Rascals.
Inspired by those kids. Wow.
Yeah. Well, you think about it, that was based during the Great Depression. You don't think about it, though. It's seen through the eyes of the children. So they're having fun, but in the background, that they come from poor circumstances. And that always had an influence on him, and the way he wanted to tell the story through the eyes of children. And you know, as the movie goes along, you start to get into the dramatics of the situation behind the scenes. But there's a lot of kind of child whimsy in the way that they create their own magical kingdom in this circumstance.
I haven't seen it yet, but Tom, you have. And the breakout star is this little girl, 7-year-old Brooklyn Prince as Mooney. Just incredible praise for her performance. Raves. Just the best child acting on screen people have seen in many, many years. Did you guys, and Tom, I know you were blown away. And Kevin,
it's remarkable acting. Let me get a quick reminder here, folks, that you are listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. We're talking with producer Kevin Chenoy of The Florida Project, a new independent film released this weekend. The actors, Kevin, that you used and the director selected, for the most part, were unknowns, were folks that aren't with a deep acting portfolio, except, of course, for Willem Dafoe, who plays the hotel manager. Was that a creative decision to try to communicate the fringe element here, this economic kind of gray market that is depicted in the film?
I mean, again, authenticity is really important to Sean. I think he does ultimately want to find people who can perform as well, right? So it's a balance. You know, you look at somebody like Willem, who is the consummate professional and incredible actor and kind of a career highlight for all of us to get to work with him. Looking at the part of Haley, the mother of Mooney, you know, that was a part that a number of people were really interested in wanting to play, but Sean was looking for something very specific and ultimately cast Bria Venate from seeing her videos on Instagram. You know, she just had a lot of charisma. I kept saying we're looking for somebody that was like a cross between a young Angelina Jolie and Amy Schumer. And, you know, she kind of...
It's an interesting combination.
Yeah, she is that person and had all this charisma. And Samantha Kwan, who is an associate producer and served as an acting coach on set, worked with Bria as well as the other kids and really bringing out that performance.
Let me ask you too, the website Rotten Tomatoes, really influential in the movie world, giving The Florida Project a 96% approval rating. Could you ever have anticipated this little low-budget independent film was going to break out like this?
You know, honestly, after the success of Tangerine, I mean, I've known Sean, we've been working together for 20 years. He was my younger brother's roommate at film school, so I've known him since he was a teenager. And he's a unique and special filmmaker. I really felt like there was an opportunity to do something special with this. Of course, you know, I'll never forget watching the first assembly of the movie as it was as a full picture, sitting around the kitchen table with my life partner and producing partner, Francesca Silvestri, both of us having just watched it, and said, we talked a lot about Brooklyn's performance. You know, when have you ever seen a child performance like that? We were both in tears, even ourselves, watching the movie and saying, this is really going to be something incredible. You just knew it. And we knew it when we were even shooting it. You kind of knew.
Yeah, I mean, people are saying not since, you know, Kwavonzene Wallace and Beast of the Southern Wild, Abigail Breslin and Little Miss Sunshine, or even going back to Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon, have we seen a kid on screen like this. So kudos to you, and kudos to Sean Baker. Kudos to the cast of The Florida Project. You know, I'm excited. There's a screening tonight here in Jacksonville, although I hear it's sold out. So you are here in Jacksonville to do a talk and discuss this. He is producer Kevin Chenoy. The Florida Project is releasing statewide. Of course, it is a Florida story. Get out and see it. It's going to be an incredibly successful film, something tells me, The Florida Project. Well, finally this hour, a quick look at how Florida parties in October. Tom, here's a hint. It involves lots of booze.
It certainly does, Melissa. But big differences between your neck of the woods and my neck of the woods about how you party in late October. Up there, it's Florida Georgia Week, and the festivities already underway in Jacksonville for the big game between the Gators and the Bulldogs. It's known as the world's largest outdoor cocktail party.
That's right. Now, Gator fan Rusty Shortridge has come to an area near the stadium called RV City. It's where football fans park their RVs and hang out and party for the whole week.
Have a few toddies together, do our big-time cooking together, and just party it up.
All right, Rusty, you do that. Now, at the opposite end of the peninsula, down in Key West.
It's a bit of a different vibe at the end of the road, Melissa. Fantasy Fest is underway in Key West. It's billed as the annual 10-day party in paradise for grown-ups. Revelers from around the globe descend on the island for parades, wild costumes, and yes, of course, the ever-present libations.
However you have fun this weekend, enjoy yourself. Well, that's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Murchard are producers.
Jason Zabka is our technical director with engineering help from Charles Michaels and Doug Peterson.
WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. Our theme music is by Miami musician Aaron Levos.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Remember, Tom, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. See you next week.